Well, here we are, just a couple of brief paragraphs, really, and some familiar ideas in them, with a less than great opening line, isn't it, there in verse 27? But to you who are listening, I say. I mean, it's cold comfort, but I suppose some encouragement to us preachers that even Jesus feared some might switch off while he was teaching. But to you who are listening, I say. Now, what he's actually doing there is to say, this matters. This bit's serious. He's grabbing their attention again as they reeled from the shock of the great reversal of fortunes in the blessings and woes we looked at last week. See back there in verse 22? Blessed are you when people hate you, exclude you, insult you because of the Son of Man. Or verse 26, woe to you when everyone speaks well of you. So how do you live that blessing? Well, what does a true disciple really look like then? What is the characteristic of God's family? But to you who are listening, I say, well, what does he say? What is the big secret, Jesus? And the answer, of course, is love. Oh, we sigh. I mean, we nod because you can't disagree with that, can you? It's like motherhood and apple pie. And then we nod off again, wondering why we came all this way to hear something as blandly nice as that. Only, of course, we should realize that if Jesus speaks, he is never just blandly nice. The love he talks about is nothing soppy. It's astonishingly generous. And that's what makes it the family likeness. That's what makes it the characteristic of our Father. Look how he summarizes it at the end of these paragraphs in verse 35. But love your enemies. Do good to them. Lend to them without expecting to get anything back. And then your reward will be great and you will be children of the Most High. Because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Staggering, isn't it? The characteristic of the Most High, the most powerful figure in the cosmos, is that he gives without expecting anything back. Now, I don't know what kind of picture of God you carry around with you, but does it square with this one? He'll love his enemies. It's not blandly nice. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. It's love for the undeserving. Look, it was back in 1990, the Boston Globe, the local newspaper, this is Boston, Massachusetts, USA, not Boston, Lincoln, England, and it carried the story of an extraordinary wedding banquet. Philip Yancey tells it about how a woman came along with her fiancé to the Hyatt Hotel and they came to order the meal in advance, you know, and they pored over all the books and chose the menu and decided on what sort of silver and flower arrangements and everything else they wanted, and they had pretty extravagant tastes, and the bill, even in those days, came to over $13,000. They put half down as a deposit and went home to sort of look at the next bit of whatever you did to plan the wedding. And the day the invites for the wedding were due to be mailed, the potential groom got cold feet. I'm just not sure, he said. I mean, it's a big commitment. Let's think about it a little longer. Well, when a couple of days later his still very angry fiancé went to the Hyatt to cancel the banquet, the events manager couldn't have been more understanding. The same thing happened to me, honey, she said, and told the story of her own broken engagement, but about the refund, she only had bad news. But the contract's binding. You're only entitled to $1,300 back. You've really only got two options. You can forfeit the rest of the down payment or go ahead with the banquet. I'm sorry, she said. I really am. And though it seemed crazy, the more the jilted bride thought about it, the more she liked the idea of going ahead with the party. I mean, not a wedding banquet, but a big blowout. You see, 10 years before, this woman had been living in a homeless shelter. She'd got back on her feet, she'd found a good job, she'd put aside a sizable nest egg, and now she had the wild notion of kind of using her savings to treat the down and outs of Boston to a night on the town. And so it was in June 1990 in the Hyatt Hotel in Boston. A party was thrown such as it had never seen before. The hostess changed the menu to boneless chicken in honor of the groom, as she put it. And she sent invitations to rescue missions and homeless shelters. And that warm summer night, people who were used to sort of peeling half-gnawed pizza off the cardboard dined instead on chicken cordon bleu. Hyatt waiters in tuxedos served hors d'oeuvre to senior citizens propped up by crutches and Zimmers. Bag ladies, vagrants, addicts took one night off from the hard life of the pavement outside and instead sipped champagne, ate chocolate wedding cake, danced to big band melodies late into the night. The down and outs experienced grace for a night. The true disciple experiences grace for eternity. The child of the Most High expresses grace for a lifetime. So let's look at this grace love a little more closely, because running through these couple of paragraphs is a contrast between what Jesus teaches and lives and what others say, what the culture expects, what we assume to be the norm. See, here's the first thing about this love. It is more than grin and bear it love. I mean, look again at the beginning, at verse 27. But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies, not just your friends. Love them. It's more than grin and bear it, isn't it? It's more than be stoical. It's more than keep a stiff upper lip. It's more than sort of suck it up and don't lash out. No, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. And please, this is real life, not just theory talk. Jesus is speaking to Jews who are living under an occupying power, and like pretty much every other set of occupying troops in history, these were troops with their fair share of incidents of abuse and oppression. Jesus is speaking to disciples whom he's just told that blessing will mean being hated, excluded, insulted, rejected. And he says, love your enemies. It's a world that for many Christians today is still very normal, but for plenty of us in the West is becoming a new reality to us. And when you get sucked into that world and you're struggling to cope, the first thought that springs to your mind is rarely, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you, verse 28. Pray for those who mistreat you. Mistreat would be far too strong a word, but I remember a staff member at college who rubbed many up the wrong way, who didn't seem to be the friend of the gospel he claimed to be, and I can remember reading these words and starting to pray for him. It changed my attitude, it changed my heart, really. I still thought he was wrong. I still thought we needed to say so. But how I thought of him, how I acted towards him, changed. It is difficult to pray for someone and stay bitter. You know, do you pray for other people, you know, regularly, routinely? I wonder if tonight isn't time to add a name or two to those you pray for. Yeah, I pray for family and friends, as I guess many of us do. But this week, as I've been reading this, I've realized I need to add an enemy or two to my prayer list. And when someone becomes an enemy, actually, our first instinct is to cross them off our prayer list, isn't it? Jesus says, pray for them. What enemy do you pray for? Or look at verse 29. If someone slaps you on one cheek, it may be a physical strike, it may be an insult, the phrase covers both ideas, and Jesus experienced both, turn to them the other also. Which is easier said than done, isn't it? And when someone takes a cheap shot at you, whether it's physically or verbally, and the blood boils and the indignation rises, and we're in kind of get-even mode or survival mode. And turning the other cheek doesn't make the top five options that come racing through my mind. And to do it involves taking hurt on yourself, absorbing pain, not lashing back, but keeping it in you rather than just hitting out and getting rid of it that way. It doesn't feel good, but then it wouldn't have felt good to Jesus on the cross, would it, as he took the beatings and the slaps and the mockery and the insults and prayed, Father, forgive them. Always forgive your enemies, the saying goes. Nothing infuriates them more. Which, of course, completely misses the point. See, the love Jesus looks for here is not point scoring or revenge. No, verse 31, do to others as you would have them do to you. That's Jesus' summary, and it's a positive one, isn't it? He doesn't say, don't do to others what you don't want them to do to yourself. He says, do. Put yourself in their shoes. How would you want to be treated, listened to, accepted, spoken to? Well, treat them like that. Verse 29, is your coat taken? Give them your shirt as well. Verse 30, give to everyone who asks, don't demand it back. Merciful loving is always thinking, what can I give? Enemies who experience that will find themselves in a very different world from just grin and bear it. Now, what Jesus talks about here is more than grin and bear it love. Secondly, it's more than tit for tat love. Look at verses 32 to 34. See, this is far more than you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. And it's not that Christians have a monopoly on love. My conversion story was not I showed no love at all to others, got converted, and then became very loving. I wasn't without love. It was just that I was selective about it. I was happy to love you if you fell into the right category, you know, someone I liked, someone I needed, someone who was useful. What I discovered when Christ found me was that God's mercy is not selective. And he doesn't expect his children to be selective either. That's what marks out the true disciple. He or she shows love across the board. Selective love is no distinguishing mark at all. Look at verse 32. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners expecting to be repaid in full. And you can't miss the message, can you? Now, even sinners do that. Even sinners do that. Even sinners do that. But this love he's talking about is radically different. This love crosses boundaries. This love breaks out of cliques. Now, have you thought what makes a clique? It's not that you've got a friendship group. Many of us have that. You know, people we know better, we share likes and preferences with, we find there's some kind of chemistry between us. Now, what makes for a clique is that we won't step out of it. Or we won't let others into it. We reserve our love and generosity for it. But this love that Jesus talks about can't be fenced in like that. Claire and I went up to Sheffield yesterday to a Ruby wedding anniversary of some good friends up there, and it was a kind of quick in and out visit, and we saw lots of friends. They'd thrown a big party, and a lot of the folk we expected to see. And as we went back, as we were reflecting on who we'd met and seen there, we thought about all the ones we expected to see, and then we both realized there were also plenty of people we wouldn't have expected to see. It was just a mark of the generosity, of the love of this couple, that actually unexpected people were there and invited as well. That their love wasn't restricted. Tony Campolo, the American professor, writer, speaker, once did some research in secular universities asking students if there was any saying of Jesus they remembered. And easily the teaching that stood out most to the unbeliever was, love your enemies. It's so unnatural. Now, for some of us, these words are very painful and personal, aren't they? You can't just kind of flick a switch and love your enemy. Love your enemy. The colleague who makes work into a daily ordeal. The family member who makes home an agony, not an oasis. Love your enemies. You could throw the line out and make it sound very glib, but it's anything but when you have to live it in real life, and enemies nearly always have history with us. Remember when I was last in Nigeria, Nigerian Christians have faced some massive violence and persecution from the likes of Boko Haram, and we were talking about it together, and what ministers actually say and teach people. And rather glibly and carelessly, I think, in response to all the violence, we said, I mean, do you just tell them to turn the other cheek? And I saw the bishop, and I could see his anger rising as he realized we Westerners were just sort of clumping in and putting a little line out and solving. And he said, listen, I'll tell you the question I'm being asked more than anything else at the moment by the Christians around here as they see the violence against them. They're saying to me this, can we defend ourselves? Oh, we know we shouldn't go on the attack and be aggressive, but when they come to wipe out our farms and kill our family, can we defend ourselves? Love your enemies. Turn the other cheek. Runs into those realities. Which is why we need to look at the next point. It's more than grin and bear it love. It's more than tit for tat love. It's more than common sense love. I mean, let me explain what I mean. My mother was a great believer in common sense. She was always telling us to use it. Hugh, why don't you use your common sense? You know, it was her mantra. I remember going to one school once, and I saw on the school notice board the only school rule is that you use your common sense. Now, common sense is a wonderful thing, but it can be infuriating as well, can't it? You know, after all, no one actually defines what it says. You know, we're all meant to instinctively know, which leaves the person talking about common sense free to define the terms. We can get so full of common sense setting our boundaries for living that we actually only read Jesus' words through their lens. And common sense can blind us to what he's saying. Now look at verse 35. The Most High is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Let me tell you, common sense will never take you there. Well, verse 29, if someone takes your coat, don't withhold your shirt from them, Jesus says. And common sense immediately asks, am I meant to take that literally? You know, what about give a person an inch and they'll take a mile? Now I'm being asked to give them a yard. Verse 30, give to everyone who asks you. In London, do I have to give to every beggar whatever they ask? Common sense asks. And I'm sure Jesus would be saying, no, but when you talk like that, you miss the point of what I'm saying. See, common sense will seize on a difficulty or an exception, and it'll be blind to the challenge. Jesus is not calling for gullibility here, but he is calling for love. Love may well turn down the beggar's demand for money when it fears that it'll just be spent on drink, but be sure it is love doing it. Not love of possessions, love of my money. Be sure it's love doing it, not stinginess of the time or the cash needed to truly care. I watched, it's not for the first time, someone begging outside Sainsbury's just up Great Portland Street, and I saw this person come up to them and talk with them, and they clearly refused to give them money, and they went into the shop, and a few minutes later they'd come out with the cup of coffee and the sandwich, and they gave that to them. The love Jesus calls for, you see, goes where common sense won't let you travel. In a world that instantly cries out to us when we're faced with the enemy or the beggar, have boundaries, manage the risks, this love crosses boundaries and embraces some risks. If someone takes your coat, don't withhold your shirt. Give and don't demand back. Lend and don't expect back. It's less a detailed blueprint for each begging situation, more that Jesus wants me to get a flavor of that unnatural love, actually to give a flavor of that unnatural love. A love that prides itself on never having been taken in by a beggar. A love that prides itself that the children never got away with anything on my watch. Leaves Jesus asking, I suspect, has the beggar or the child ever experienced grace from you? The true disciple, the true child of God, will show this love, the extravagance of that hired hotel party, the generosity that's the opposite of the tight-fisted, penny-pinching financial equivalent of eye-for-eye, tooth-for-tooth approach. And we mustn't go to the poor and deprived of London, and I don't just mean materially, but spiritually as well, with mere common sense love. The love of verse 35, the love of the Most High, is love for the ungrateful and the wicked, and it's really ready to lose out love. Do you realize that the coat of verse 29 was the one item that was my inalienable right to keep under Old Testament law? If you borrowed my coat, you had to get it back to me by sundown, because it would be some people's blanket as well, their only protection against the cold of the night. And Jesus speaks of a forfeit what I have a right to love. Common sense can't compute. And that love is a sign of a chip off the old block of a child of the Father. But then, of course, Jesus would know, because he lived that love like Father, like Son. He, you remember, did not count equality with God something to be grasped. He emptied himself. He became a nobody, a servant. In human likeness, it went to death, even death on a cross. He poured out the love, and God exalted him to the highest place. Gave him the name above every name. See verse 35, then your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High. The God of the great reversal will honor his own. Want to talk about common sense love? Don't go there. Now, his love meant, while we were still powerless, while we were still ungodly, while we were still sinners, while we were still enemies, Christ died for us. That's the love that brings us life and hope. That's the love poured into me. That's the love he looks to see flowing out of me. be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. Love your enemies may be the most familiar of lines for people, but when you start to unpick it, it's uncomfortably familiar, not blandly nice, isn't it? Two or three things we might want to lodge in our hearts and minds before we rush away tonight. Here's the first, a mercy to ask for. If you're like me, you fall short of showing this love. I've got to cry, Lord, have mercy. Here's the second thing, an enemy to pray for. Maybe God's already been putting the name of an enemy in your heart and mind. Well, just lodge it there. Make sure it gets onto your prayer list. Maybe in just a moment's quiet, we ask God to make clear, who should we be praying for? A Jesus to thank for. For this is a love first received from Jesus. It's the only reason we can give. So let's take a moment of quiet to ask for mercy, to pray for an enemy, to thank the Jesus who loves us like this.